and be changed into the image of his likeness. Amen. Well, there is a theory that most Christian growth, or if perhaps even all Christian growth, takes place at the point of need or weakness. When we're kind of at our worst or weakest is when we grow the most. Robert Warren, Christian leader, wrote 2 books on that theme with the telling titles of In the Crucible and On the Anvil. Suggests his understanding of learning. And there is a trend through John's Gospel that Jesus gives his deepest teaching in points where the disciples find themselves in those situations. When Jesus says, I am the resurrection and the life, it's not announced at the triumphant end of the story where Lazarus is raised in Bethany, but he says it while Martha and Mary are still weeping in despair at the disappointment of Lazarus's death. In the upper room, it is to confused and frightened disciples that Jesus speaks words of life and peace. So when John records Jesus saying, do not let your hearts be troubled. You believe in God, trust also in me. That's exactly the same trend. Because Jesus makes this statement and invitation to deeply worried disciples. They were worried about death. Jesus had been teaching dark things about the death of the Son of Man. They were worried about life. Jesus had been talking about going away and coming back. How on earth can we carry on without him? And in John's Gospel, not long before our reading, Jesus had predicted that Peter of all people, would fail him. And of course, that came hard on the heels of Jesus predicting Judas's betrayal. Everything the disciples thought that they had understood is unraveling before their very eyes. What in the world is going on? So it is to confused and distressed disciples that Jesus first says, do not let your hearts be troubled. Trust in God. Trust also in me. Not to comfortably reclining in the Galilean hills with Jesus, but to worried and distressed disciples. Do not let your hearts be troubled. Trust also in God. Trust also in me. Or as a modern paraphrase puts it in the Message, don't let this throw you. You trust God, don't you? Trust me. Well, Jesus could be just as well speaking today. Speaking to us, rather than to those disciples a long time ago. In today's world, you don't have to be a Christian disciple to be worried and or upset by what is going on. You just have to be awake, alive, and alert. I'm not going to go through some great litany of all the challenges we face, because they're pretty much self-evident. The list of political uncertainty, global economic, political, the rise of nationalism. You've got every possible thing to worry about. And all this before we even start on the personal pressures, where so many people are facing job pressure, money worries, family and marriage pressure, hard decisions that they have to face. Well, it's cheered you up no end, hasn't it? So with all this going on, it's no surprise that the relieving stress is a multi-billion pound industry or euro industry across the world. You can buy tapes of whales singing or babbling brooks to calm you down. Every kind of advice about how to de-stress and be present. The other day I came across Palmolive Aromatherapy Anti-Stress Shower Gel. Not in my own bathroom, I hasten to add. But I suppose every little must help, but I think I do need something a bit more than shower gel to overcome my stress. And for Christians, there is, of course, in a sense, the added pressure of our hope and longing for God to save a world in desperate need and the opposition that we may face simply by holding to the truth of Jesus. We live in a world that in many places is subtly or overtly hostile to the Christian message. You're probably aware of people like Richard Dawkins in the West, in the intellectual realm. He had a multi-million selling book, The God Delusion. At the start of the book, Richard Dawkins writes this: "If this book works as I intend, religious readers who open it will be atheists when they put it down." And certainly in the West, there is this whole outlook of cultured despising and contempt for the Christian faith. But in many other parts of the world, it's not so much intellectual contempt, well, as overtly violent opposition to Christian faith. So it is to this troubled world, our troubled world and to us, that Jesus still says, "Do not let your hearts be troubled. Trust in God, trust also in me." And to do that, the first thing we need to do is to appreciate just who is saying this to us. Who is this Jesus who gives us this important invitation? Who does Jesus think telling us not to worry? What qualifies him to speak so confidently about life? I mean, telling us not to worry feels like the worst possible piece of advice. You know, when he says, "Do not be worried," that gives me more to worry about. I'm worried about being worried and worried about disobeying Jesus when he says, "Don't worry." I love the conversation between Jesus and Thomas in verse 5 and 6 and 7, where just Thomas says, "Lord, you know, spell it out. What are we supposed to do? Where are you going?" Thomas is one of my personal favorites among the disciples. I preached the other week about he's not doubting Thomas. He's full of faith, Thomas. But here, well, Thomas is honest. He's the one person who's prepared to say, "What's going on? Can you explain it? Draw me a picture. What is going on? Will you tell me?" He's the kind of person who finds it hard to go, beyond what he can see in the here and now. He just kind of wants to know what the route map is. I always think of him as a Yorkshireman, really. No offense to those people who live down south in Yorkshire. He's the kind of person, if he was sitting on a train and looking out the window and the sun's shining and the person opposite says, "Oh, what a lovely day," I always feel Thomas would go, "It is on this side of the train anyway." So what kind of answer does honest Thomas expect to his question? How can we know the way? Does he want a map? A set of directions? A book of instructions? Well, the answer Jesus gives him is not first very helpful. He says, "Well, you know the way. Or at least you ought to, if you appreciate who I am and you would know God. You want to know the way? I am the way, the truth, and the life," says Jesus. So the answer to your question, Thomas, is a person. Thomas, this question is not like solving a puzzle. You're not looking for an answer. You're looking for a person. It isn't solving a puzzle. Some people really like puzzles. I do the occasional crossword, but I'm not really a puzzle person. Life is complicated enough. I am, however, married to someone who likes puzzles. 40 years, there you go. Must be good. My wife loves particularly those Sudoku puzzles. You know, they're about numbers in squares. I am a good husband, I claim. So I did one of those Sudoku things once. That was enough. But Jesus is not offering a solution to a puzzle or a problem, but a way of life and a person to get to know himself. Someone put it like this: Jesus is the way, the truth, and the life. Without the way, there is no going. Without the truth, there is no knowing. Without the life, there is no living. Jesus says, don't start with some vague idea about God and life in your own mind. Start with me and go from there. Now, the mind of every true disciple has to be illuminated by God's Spirit as to who Jesus is. Because who is this person saying, "Trust me"? Trust me. Trust me, says Jesus, and you will find not one way, but the only way to live, to really live. Trust me, says Jesus, and you will find the truth. Not some kind of abstract or academic idea, but a life that rings true. You know, your life will have integrity to it. Trust me, says Jesus, and you will find the life, not a lifestyle. Have you noticed these days people talk about lifestyle? No, we're talking about life here. Life that is worth living and a life for others. Because that's what this life is about. It's about a life for others. Trust me, says Jesus, and you trust the God who gives you this life in the first place. So once we appreciate who this Jesus is, the one who makes this extraordinary offer, then we appreciate how brilliant it is to be part of his kingdom in verses 12 to 14. Where we see that there is a kingdom to be part of. It's not about us having a quiet life, loving and serving Jesus. It's about entering his work and the work of the Father. Verses 12 to 14. Truly, truly, I say to you, whoever believes in me or else believes in me will do the works that I do. And greater works than these will he do. Because I am going to the Father. Whatever you ask in my name, this I'll do, that your Father may be glorified in the Son. It's this sense of becoming part of something so much bigger than ourselves. When we appreciate who Jesus really is, he's making this invitation, the way, the truth, the life, we find ourselves enrolled in his Father's business on earth. And that puzzling comment Jesus makes about doing even greater things reminds us that, well, this kingdom work is not defined by the limits of Jesus' own ministry. He was here at one place in one time doing stuff. But we're no longer bound by those limits, that by his Spirit we participate in this great work. So the invitation from Jesus to discover him, the way, the truth, and the life, is not to have a recipe for a quiet, easy life. It's not about us seeking personal peace and tranquility. It's about a transformed life. He transforms us so that God may transform this world through us. Christian discipleship is about enlisting in the great cause of God's work on earth. I've heard it put that the gospel is not just a way in, it is a way on. The way that God has chosen on this earth to transform and renew it. That's nothing less than the vision of Jesus. If he really is, as he claims, the way, the truth, and the life, this is an invitation to be part of something wonderful. All over the world, I'm excited by what God is doing through his people. One of the good things about this global connected world is we can actually find out about what's going on in different parts of the world. While in Hong Kong, it was great to catch up on extraordinary things that God is doing there and to hear more of what is happening in China. But I got some statistics recently. They're from the UK. I apologize for that. They came from the London Institute for Contemporary Christianity, Mark Green, doing very good work there. They're kind of guesstimates about what the Christians are doing in the UK. The dangerous people are full of doom and gloom about the UK at the minute, but never mind, about the church and its life. But he had some statistics about what the churches are doing in the UK, and he puts it like this. Who in the UK runs free holiday clubs for up to 2 million children? Who runs 50,000 youth clubs? Who has twice as many youth workers as the government? Who? Who cares? Christians through churches. Who visit 450,000 housebound people a week? Who visits 350,000 people in hospitals a week? Who runs 12,000 drop-in centres and 20,000 mums and toddlers groups? Who? Christians through the churches. Worldwide, no group does more service outside of its own community, its own kinship group, than the Christian church. That was one of the great things in the early Roman eras, when people were fleeing because of plagues. It was the Christians who would care for those who weren't Christians at great risk to themselves. Going back in Hong Kong, when the outbreak of SARS, sudden respiratory syndrome, where people were dying for no apparent reason. It was the Christian doctors and nurses who volunteered to care for the dying, a number of whom died of the virus themselves. That made a great impression in that culture. Now, the Christian community is called to be a signpost that we are seeking to represent God's kingdom, the way, the truth, the life, that is Jesus. This extraordinary enterprise on earth that is working for his kingdom. That's the deal. Early in Tolkien's book, The Fellowship of the Ring, Gandalf tells Frodo of the return to power of the enemy, the Dark Lord Sauron. And Frodo responds, "I wish it need not have happened in my time." Gandalf says, "So do I, and so do all who live to see such times. But that is not for them to decide. All we have to decide is what to do with the time that is given us." I'm sure we'd all like to live in a world that is more settled, politically wise, economically just, peaceful, righteous, and comfortable than one we have today. But we as the people of God have to decide, all we have to decide is how will we respond to the task that God gives us in these times. And God's call is to appreciate who Jesus is and to appreciate the exciting possibilities of serving his kingdom here on earth. And in this place, in this time, Jesus says to us, "Do not let your hearts be troubled. Believe in God, believe also in me." We do this because we know that ultimately our life is secure with Jesus and his kingdom, the one who is the way, the truth, and the life. Let me pray for us for a moment.